Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Today we are welcoming our guest, Eric Hatala Mathis, to help us ask the question, what should we save for posterity? When I was growing up in the 1970s and 80s, there was a lot of discussion about the evils of materialism. There was a widely felt cultural belief that Americans in particular had too much stuff. Objects can't make you happy, people were told. It was square and inauthentic to keep up with the Joneses. Over the years, these complaints morphed into a critique of consumerism in general. People had become nothing more than commercial agents with manufactured desire, and products were built for obsolescence, or so people claimed. My generation turned our backs on rock bands who sold out, and the faculty I met early in my career were rending their garments over student evaluations that were just consumer satisfaction surveys in disguise. At the same time, the cultural conversation moved away from condemning buying things. Alternative culture became synonymous with collectibles, and people started hanging out at Starbucks. Today, younger folks complain about late-stage capitalism. They understandably fear that they will never pay off their student loans or own their own houses, but there is almost no critical discourse about retail therapy or comfort buying. What America has experienced since World War II is a fundamental renegotiation of what it means to externalize our identities. We went from a nation with minimal stuff to one that defined ourselves by it. But we never really had the deeper conversation about what these objects actually do. Case in point, I used the phrase retail therapy a moment ago. It refers to the jolt of chemical pleasure people get when they buy things. It combines the neurology of addiction with the economic assumption that someone is never more satisfied with a product than the moment they get it. YouTube is full of unboxing videos, voyeuristic displays of electronics being unwrapped, but has a lot less content about appreciation what we already have. In short, we understand incredibly well the psychology of getting, but we devote very little attention to having or remembering. That's what today's episode is about. Let me explain. The world always changes, and the things around us fade into oblivion. This includes consumer goods, but also more monumental or abstract things, Stonehenge, the Cherokee language, bullfighting. Species become extinct and works of art lose meaning before they physically decompose. Cultural practices become fragmented. Almost everything that has been in the world doesn't actually exist anymore, and everything that does will eventually go away. If things are so transient, which ones should we work to preserve? And which ones should we try to remember? This is where our guest comes in. He will help us discover how to strategize and prioritize amongst the countless things that are disappearing as we speak. He's going to offer us a philosophy of conservation and begins by acknowledging that these externalities are components of our identities. It's not that a t-shirt or painting has intrinsic value, although it might, as we shall see. It's they are expressions of who we are, as well as the building blocks of who we eventually become. This is a very different perspective than the anti-materialism that I began with. It's not that objects do or don't make us happy. It's that they reveal what happiness might be. Don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that our guest will encourage us to fill our McMansions with useless crap. He's not offering us a philosophy of endless consumption. He explores our activities as much as our possessions. Nevertheless, he will rightly point out that understanding what we need to preserve begins with embracing the relationship between identity and context. The argument for a refrigerator is easy. The argument for keeping our grandmother's hand-sewn quilt is more complex. The same can be said about cultural practices. A powwow is profoundly valuable for the Native Americans who participate in it, but a philosopher isn't going to be satisfied with its justification being reduced to tradition, that it's good because it's always been done. Instead, we'll want to know what these gatherings mean to the participants and why their particular tradition should be preserved when, say, the tradition of slavery should not be. We may ask similar questions about marriage. There are reasons why so many people fought so long to legalize gay marriage. We can also ask similar questions about protecting the family farm, celebrating a quinceañera, or protecting elephants. All of this is to say that the argument for conservation is more than just how to protect natural resources. It's about human artifacts, behaviors, practices, or to put it more succinctly, our histories. To have an identity is to be part of a story, and for stories to make sense, we need to be able to follow the continuity. A comic book may be just as meaningful to someone as a wedding dress is. The reason for keeping both, and the method for doing so, are really about the relationship the owners want to embrace. It's not that the objects or the activities per se that matter. It is what they represent and how they cultivate our values. And now our guest. Eric Hatala-Mathis is a professor of philosophy at Wellesley College. He's the author of two books, Drawing the Line, What to Do with the Work of Immoral Artists from Museums to the Movies, and the more recent, What to Save and Why, Identity, Authenticity, and the Ethics of Conservation. Both are published by Oxford University Press. Eric, welcome to Why.
Thanks, Jack. Happy to be here.
To our listeners, if you'd like to participate, please share your favorite moments from the show and tag us on social networks. Our handle is always at Why Radio Show. That's WHY Radio Show. Rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or your preferred podcast platform so that others can find the show and listen to all 18 seasons worth of episode for free, as well as our sister show, Philosophical Currents, at our website, whyradioshow.org. And as always, this show can only happen with your support. We exist solely on listener contributions, so click donate in the upper right-hand corner of our website to make your tax-deductible donation through the University of North Dakota Alumni Foundation portal. We're going to be talking about conservation, but almost everyone listening will only know this in terms of the ecology, in terms of environmental conservation. What made you think about it in a wider context? Why do you use the term conservation to apply to objects and culture as well as the world around us?
Yeah, thanks, Jack. So one context that people are going to be familiar with regarding conservation is the environment, like you say. Another might be museums, right? So when you go to a museum, like a big art museum, sometimes you'll see a conservation department, right, where you know that they're are professionals who are taking care of the collection, right? And sometimes they're even open, right? They'll have sort of like glass walls. You can sort of see them working. So I work in a bunch of different areas of philosophy, including in environmental philosophy and philosophy of art. So, you know, I had this sense that, well, there are folks who are thinking about conservation issues in the environment, and there are folks who are thinking about conservation issues in art. And so I got curious, so what are the relationships or the differences between the ways in which conservation is being pursued in these very different spaces? I've always been really compelled by Wilfred Sellers' explanation of what philosophy is. He said, to paraphrase, that philosophy is about how things, in the general sense of the term, hang together in the general sense of the term. So I've always been really interested in that sort of philosophy as a 30,000-foot view. Like, what do we learn when we can step back and see the relationships among similar ideas and practices across lots of different contexts? So the more I got thinking about conservation in the environment and conservation in art and the different sort of literatures that exist on those topics, I just started seeing a concern with saving things everywhere, right? It was just like everywhere I looked, I was seeing all these examples of people getting really worked up about the importance of saving things, whether it was, you know, objects that they cared about or places that they loved or activities that they were deeply engaged in. And so I wanted to investigate and learn more about what we could learn about why people are so interested in saving things and maybe also some of the values and even moral and political complications that attend our interest in trying to save the things that we care about.
I want to pull that thread about people getting worked up about this. But before I do, being a philosopher, I have a terminological question, which is, why is this conservation and not preservation? Why do you couch it in those terms? Because I think a lot of people, myself included, when we see people restoring paintings and things like that, it feels more like preserving than conserving. Is there a difference between those two words, and is that difference meaningful?
Yeah, this is a very fraught terminological question. So not one that's super easy to answer. So like the short answer is that the terms conservation and preservation actually get used in very different ways in different contexts and in different places. So for example, in the US environmental context, it's fairly familiar to think about preserving nature in terms of saving it for its own sake, and think of environmental conservation in terms of saving nature in a way that will be good for us, for people, right? And so there's a contrast that sometimes gets drawn there. That same distinction doesn't necessarily apply to how we think about architectural conservation in England, for example. So I use conservation as just sort of like the blanket term for saving stuff in general. Sometimes it's helpful to think more specifically about whether we're saving something for its own sake, just because it's good to save it, versus saving it for some other goal or end. But yeah, that's how I think about conservation, just sort of for simplicity, at least in the context of the book.
Does that give one of the two categories more moral value or worth? I mean, if we're saving something for its own sake, is that more noble than if we're saving it for us or for our purposes? Is one more intertwined with exploitation, utility in natural resources terms, extraction? Or in the end, does it just sort of wash out because you're preserving or conserving the thing and it's there when we want it to be?
Yeah, I don't think that there's necessarily a sort of morally freighted difference between the two, because saving things for our own sake doesn't necessarily mean saving them for some sort of like instrumental or extractive end, right? So like one way that things can be valuable for us or for people is they can be instrumentally valuable, right? Like we have some sort of goal and something is important because it helps us to achieve that goal. But other things can be good for us, for people, right? Just because of the things that they are, right? In a sort of non-instrumental sense, but that still makes them good for our sake, right? So just because something's good for our sake doesn't mean we need to think about it in this sort of like instrumental terms. So I think both of them can be morally important. I wouldn't necessarily privilege one or the other.
Maybe this is the wrong way of phrasing the question, but there's this view that I like in the autumn that I jog by, and there's an angle when I can see the river next to my town with trees. It's in a beautifully manicured park. And I get this vista that I find really beautiful and satisfying. But part of what's happening that I'm seeing is, I don't want to say letting nature run wild, but certainly letting nature do its own thing. Mm-hmm. If I'm preserving that view, am I preserving it for itself or am I preserving it for me? If I value something because of the aesthetics, because it makes me happy that it's there, does that still make it anthropocentric, for lack of a better word? Is it still about me, or can I appreciate things and still value them intrinsically for themselves?
Yeah, I think you can do both. I mean, it would depend on, you know, the details about why exactly you're engaging in the preservation. But to sort of take your example, right? If you want to save a vista because you enjoy it aesthetically, but your aesthetic enjoyment of the vista is in turn dependent upon it being a vista that involves nature doing its own thing, right? Then those might both be operative in our thinking about why it's worth preserving, right? So we could say the vista is valuable for its own sake because it's an instance of sort of nature being nature. And that's precisely what makes it valuable to you, right? So if it were artificial, say, it was just sort of like a Disney-engineered vista of nature, you wouldn't value it in the same way, even though in both cases we might say that whatever value is there aesthetically is a value that's for you or for your benefit. So I do think we can sort of combine those different approaches in this case.
I want to go back to the thing that you said earlier, that part of what attracted you to see these connections was seeing people in different contexts getting worked up over preserving or conserving these various different things. Is getting worked up about it enough of a moral imperative to do it? And what I mean by this is the argument for conservation an argument about the need to preserve things because they exist in the world, because their existence is valuable, because they contribute something meaningful? Or is the desire to conserve, does it come from our emotional needs? And therefore, if we stopped caring about them, there wouldn't necessarily be a moral imperative. Does it come from emotional need, or does it come from something larger outside of an individual person or group's experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think that those two different ways of thinking about it can often be in dialogue with each other, right? So there are some things where we think, well, this is a really valuable thing in the world. And even if people didn't care that much about it, we might say they really should, right? And so we might indeed campaign to get them to care, right? So this is like a familiar issue that comes up in nature conservation or wildlife conservation, right? You might have certain species in certain places where maybe the worry is that people don't care that much, but conservationists say, like, you really ought to care about this thing, right? There's value here that you ought to be responding to on an emotional level. So you should get worked up about it, right? So that's sort of like one way this can play out, but it's not the only way, right? So like some things seem to gain some of their value because of the fact that lots of people care about them, where we might not say, like, look, everybody really ought to care about this, but the fact that lots of people care of it is indicative of some kind of value that we actually might otherwise overlook. So in that sense, our sort of strong emotional responses to saving things can be revealing of value that we might otherwise have overlooked. So I really think it can go both ways. You can sort of run the thinking in both directions.
Is there a hierarchy of value in the sense that, okay, I understand the need to have elephant sanctuaries and care about them, and elephants are noble creatures and expending energy and resources and making regulations and all that stuff, that makes sense to me. But if I was at an important concert and the guitar player threw the guitar pick at me and I grabbed it and I kept it and I said, I want to keep George Harrison's guitar pick for my great grandchildren. That feels a little sillier, a little less meaningful. Is there a hierarchy of value at work here? And is that just subjective, or is there work to suggest that some things are just more inherently valuable than others and we should conserve that stuff first?
Yeah, that's a really tricky question. So, you know, I think the first thing to acknowledge is that the fact that we can't save everything is sort of like the state of play that makes the kinds of questions that we're talking about particularly challenging and meaningful, right? If we could just save everything that anybody had an interest in saving, then you might think, well, why not, right? Like, if somebody cares about this and, you know, there's no trade-off involved in saving it, then like, why wouldn't we save it? But of course, that's not the case, right? We do face these trade-offs. We can't save everything. We are constrained in our time and energy and resources. And so then we have to say, okay, like, well, what are the things that we are going to devote our time and attention to saving? And so that does put questions about comparisons and hierarchies of value on the table. I don't think it's especially straightforward to give some kind of hierarchy of value. So the elephant versus the guitar pick case is a helpful one. I think that there's something intuitive about saying, well, look, like, elephants as living creatures are much more important than George Harrison's guitar pick. And if we were faced with a choice between one or the other, that we should, you know, rightly save the elephants instead of the guitar pick. But the thing is that the trade-offs that we face aren't often structured that way. So like, even if we wanted to say that, like, yes, if you were, you know, if an evil demon came to you and said, you must choose one, the elephant or the guitar pick, you might say, well, like, obviously save the elephant. This is like a living creature. And the guitar pick at the end of the day is just a guitar pick, whatever its associations might be. But that's not often the kind of trade-off that we face when we're thinking about conservation. And often we're thinking about cases where there are plenty of available time and resources and energy out there among people to save all kinds of different things without actually having to choose just between, you know, option A and option B. And so sometimes it's a matter of trying to get people to see, well, what makes this worth saving? In addition to this, you know, how can you approach the possibility of spending some of your time or resources or energy to save elephants and George Harrison's guitar pick when it actually is often possible for us to do both? So sometimes the trade-offs that we face aren't between saving object A and object B. It's between saving something and spending our time on something that has nothing to do with conservation at all. And then so it's often conservationists, whether they're interested in the environment or art or collectibles, right, are interested in trying to like get people to see that saving things in general is worth their time, as opposed to, you know, whatever, watching TV.
So while there is conflict that comes out of scarcity, there's also conflict that comes out of priorities, right?
Yes.
That what we regard, how we organize our life, that a lot of this is really about the larger questions of how we're going to organize our life and what we're going to think of as important in general, not just in the specific case. Is that right?
Yes, for sure.
When we come back from the break, I want to ask you to untangle the relationship between meaning and value, because I think that's at play here. And I'm going to start off by talking about a particular object that is layered that I have and see your reaction to that. And then we'll start to pull the thread more deeply in terms of questions of agency and authenticity and appropriation and all these other themes that you've talked about in the book. But until then, you are listening to Eric Hatala-Mathis and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
And we're back. You're listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. My guest, Eric Hatala-Mathis, is a philosopher who's working on the philosophy of conservation and asking what kind of things we should preserve for posterity, and asks whether there are some methods that are superior or problematic. And as we're talking about these things, I'm thinking about this little stone I have in a drawer in my desk. Many years ago, I took a group of students to Vienna, Austria for a 3-week course on aesthetics, philosophy of art. And one of the things we did was we visited a concentration camp outside of the city. And a student did what she wasn't supposed to do, and she took a pebble from the ground of the concentration camp, and in a very meaningful gesture that meant a lot to me, after the trip she gave it to me, and she said that you know, she wanted me to remember the experience. She knows my personal history, being Jewish, and blah blah blah. And so it was a very nice gift that had a lot of historical meaning. But I have at the time a young kid in the house, and I have a daughter, and I was really freaked out at the idea of her, Adina, ever touching the stone. I felt like there would be a kind of corruption and evil that would get transferred, that if she came in contact with the stone, it would make the evil and the history all the more real and all the more palpable. And just the idea of her being any kind of physical contact with that was so horrifying to me that I preserved and loved the stone, but I also hated and feared the stone. And I guess I want to ask you, Eric, I'm both preserving something and afraid of something, and I'm attaching a word you use in the book, contagion, that the history of one thing can move along with another. How do we think about this complex object and the emotional layeredness in terms of what's valuable and what shouldn't be conserved?
Yeah, what a great story. That's very evocative for me as well, because as it happens, my grandfather was a Viennese Jew who fled from Vienna and came to the
U.S. I did not know that.
So that's part of the, that's part of the story about how I'm here. Yes, my grandfather came to New York and was, his first job was as a French-speaking coffee roaster at the World's Fair in Queens. In the 30s.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating case, right? So, I mean, one of the things that that case draws out, as you referred to before the break, is that things can carry different kinds of meaning without that necessarily meaning that they have value in the sense of being like good, right? Like some things are meaningful in a way that we might think is bad. And some things are worth remembering and worth saving because they have an important meaning, even when we don't think that they're good. So different kinds of memorials can be great examples of that. So, you know, somebody might say, well, why on earth would you preserve a concentration camp? Why wouldn't you just sort of level that thing because of its evilness, right? But an alternative approach to say, no, actually, this is something that's worth remembering, right? Because it has a really important meaning, even though it's a meaning that's associated with evil, right? It's not valuable. That's not the reason to preserve it. Or to take it, you know, from a different perspective, you might say that the value there, to the extent that there is as a reminder what's possible when evil people become, right, powerful and can carry out their will. So I think that, you know, it's one of those cases where the complexity of the different kinds of associations with it can make it particularly fraught for thinking about, like, well, what's the best way to preserve it? And this is often also where we have debates about preserving things that are associated with negative histories and thinking, what's the right way to do that or the best way to do that? And there's not always a super clear answer, right? Like, there's often different ways of trying to reconcile the meaning of certain objects with their negative associations as well. And so I'm loath to think that we should, you know, just destroy or not preserve anything just because it has negative associations, because, you know, there can also be, right, this significant importance that comes from remembering negative aspects of our past as well, lest we forget them.
And how we present these things is also relevant and important, right? Because the United States in the last, let's say, 5 to 10 years have been involved in this conversation about Confederate memorials, right? And whether or not the statues of Confederate generals should be preserved. The decision was to take them down in many respects. Then the next administration pushed that, and now the current administration wants to take memorials about slavery away and African American leaders and things like that. And one of the things that I always wanted to say about the Confederate monument was that there's something in between keeping it up and taking it down, which is keeping it up and putting a plaque that says, this is here because people wanted to remember it, but it is bad because of this, right? That you can have memorials that are complex and pedagogical and articulate the discourse. So how much is the way that we present, the way we talk about, the way we look at the preserved items, how relevant is that to what we shouldn't and how we should or shouldn't conserve things?
So monuments are a great case, because one of the things, you know, that's important about monuments is that they are located in particular places, right? And they're part of particular communities. So one of the things that I try to articulate in the book is the importance of relevant communities being involved in decisions about how to save things or why to save things. And so one of the things that you might get from a case like monuments that are, you know, or Confederate monuments that are found in many different places is you might have different communities making different decisions about how to approach this question about whether these monuments should be preserved or how they should be preserved or where they should be preserved, right? So one community might take an approach where they want to erect a counter monument, right? Some other thing that is part of that location that is in dialogue with the monument while keeping the original monument. Some might want to contextualize with, you know, more information or a plaque like you were mentioning. Others might say like, no, actually for our community, what's going to be best is to actually, is to just get rid of this monument. Like we don't want this here at all. And I think that it's without engaging in a kind of community oriented, you know, hopefully like democratic process of actually having those debates play out, sort of relevant impacted community members thinking together about what's going to be the best choice for them. I think it's hard to say in the abstract, well, this is the right way to do it, or that's the right way to do it, because different approaches can each speak to different values that we might achieve by, say, contextualizing a monument or removing it, depending on where it is and who's involved in the decision.
How important, or rather, how do we decide which groups are part of the conversation? Because certainly there are instances in which it's pretty obvious who will have conversations. But in a lot of discussions, even the question of who you're going to listen to or let participate is itself very conflict oriented. How important is it to get the participants right?
Yeah, I think it's quite important to get the participants right. And I agree that it's not always obvious how to do that, right, in a clear way. So take a case involving a preservation issue in a town. So I'll mention a case that comes up in the book. I live in a small town in Massachusetts, and I used to live in a different small town in Massachusetts that had this big preservation controversy where there's a small dam in the town. And they did an environmental impact assessment, and it was determined that like the dam wasn't great for the river ecosystem. It also needed to be repaired. It was going to cost a huge amount of money to be repaired. And so, you know, whatever the relevant town committee was like, we're going to get rid of this dam. And some people got really upset about it, right? Because they said, no, this dam is like an iconic part of the town. It's been here for like 100 years. It's part of our landscape. And they had really strong associations between their identity as members of the town and this dam and saving this dam. So in a case like that, what I want to say is, well, look, everybody in the town is a relevant party here, right? Like everybody should be part of these conversations. I don't think we should exclude, right, people from the debate about whether or not this dam should be saved. And I think it's also really important to see that link between the way in which people are thinking about their identity as town members and the preservation of that dam, because it helps to explain why they got so worked up about it, you know? Because like from a certain perspective, you might say like, look, come on guys, like it's just like a dam on the river. Like why is this such a big deal? But if you recognize the way in which, you know, something that might seem trivial, like this dam, is tied to these people's identity, then you can better understand where they're coming from. Now, the fact that it's tied to their identity doesn't necessarily justify keeping the dam, right? You have to weigh that against these other competing considerations. But I think being able to sort of see the way in which saving things is connected to people's sense of self can be really important for people to be able to sort of come to the table together and understand where each other are coming from. Now, sometimes people's sense of identity actually needs to be revised for moral and political reasons. So like when you get back to the Confederate monuments case, right, you might have certain Southerners who think about Confederate monuments as part of Southern heritage. And they might say like, well, you know, we should save these things because they're part of our heritage, even if there's something, you know, sort of negative about them. And then part of the conversation, right, recognizing the way in which these people see the monument as part of their identity might be to say, maybe one thing that we need to do is sort of like recast how we think about this aspect of Southern identity, to not erase the concerns that, say, Black Southerners have about these monuments, but recognize that just because they're part of your identity doesn't mean that they're good, right, or worth preserving in an uncritical way. And so that can maybe open up space for a more productive dialogue where people can really sort of like see where each other are coming from and then see what steps need to be taken to find a kind of resolution.
What happens when that conversation about identity gets buried under the cultural debates about injustice or impropriety? I'm thinking of two different examples that you use in the book, one of which I find funny and one which is not funny at all. The one that is funny, which I know you included because it's funny, is the preservation of the Kansas City taco. Right, the idea that Kansas City has an authentic taco is sort of bizarre, and to want to preserve that seems, at minimum, a confusion about what cuisine should be or what culture should be. Although, maybe not, because fusion and things evolve, and then the debate about returning the marble that the British Museum uses to the Parthenon, because the folks who run the British Museum said the museum and its contents, while the product of colonialism, is essential to the British identity. And that's an interesting claim, because what they're saying is, yes, for many people, being colonized is essential to their identity, and that needs to be recognized. But being colonizers is also essential to our identity, and this represents who we are, and we're not going to give it up because this is what it means to be British. How do you deal with, again, one sort of lighter and one heavier situation in which the question about conservation is buried under these larger questions of group identity and injustice and conflict and making people invisible who, or keeping the invisibility or cultivating the invisibility of people who are already marginalized or invisible?
Yeah, great. So, I mean, I can't say I've had a Kansas City taco, but I love the Kansas City taco case. It is sort of funny, but like, I don't think it's silly that people want to save the Kansas City taco, right? So like the context there, right, was that people were worried about, or this particular food writer was worried about the Kansas City taco kind of like being sort of stamped out of existence because of what he saw as kind of a weird obsession that other people had with quote unquote authentic, right, Mexican style tacos. And so this led the author that was writing about this to sort of get worried about the way in which appeals to authenticity get used, right? Because you can use an appeal to authenticity as kind of like a weapon, right? It gets weaponized in this context, right? Where it says like, we should forget these inauthentic Kansas City style tacos, right? We want authentic Mexican style tacos. But I think what's interesting there is that like, I don't think the problem is actually with authenticity or sort of appeals to authenticity. It's just about how those appeals are being made in that particular case, because one might just as well say, hey, we want to save authentic Kansas City style tacos. That matters too, because they actually have their own interesting history and heritage, and there are people that care about them for the same kinds of reasons that other people might care about authentic Mexican style tacos. So, you know, I think that's a kind of case where you can see where different communities might have different interests. Those aren't necessarily in tension with each other, right? Like you can save both of those kinds of tacos. That's actually not a case where there should be a trade-off. It only becomes a trade-off if people start sort of like weaponizing appeals to authenticity to say like, well, only one kind of taco is worthwhile, right? It's like there's room for both. Embrace pluralism about different kinds of tacos.
And I will eat them all.
Yeah,
I will eat them all,
exactly.
Right? For the record.
Yeah, love tacos. Yeah, the point about the British Museum and sort of the relationship of British identity to the Parthenon marbles is really interesting. I think it relates to what I was trying to say earlier about the relationship between identity and preservation in the Southern Confederate kind of case. And that is, right, there's a distinction we can make between recognizing that something is part of your history or part of your heritage and thinking that it is, you know, by that stroke, a good thing or something that you need to sort of lean into or try to hang on to. there's another avenue, right, which is to say, recognize that something is part of your heritage, that's an important part of your history. So it shouldn't be ignored or forgotten, right? Like it is a really fundamental part of that history. But it's something towards which you should adopt a more critical attitude, right? So the fact that, you know, there is an interesting history and a story we can tell about how the British came to acquire the Parthenon marbles and, you know, the significance that their being in the British Museum has had, you know, for, you know, multiple generations of English citizens. We can tell that story, but then reconcile that with a more critical approach that says, yeah, but maybe they were acquired in an unjust way. And so the fact that you've incorporated them into your sense of identity doesn't necessarily dictate that there's never going to be a reason to return them, especially, you know, when the Greeks have constructed a very lovely museum where there are empty spaces where they're going to put the marble pieces that are missing from the British Museum. The fact that something is part of your identity doesn't necessarily mean that it is a uncritically good part of your identity or something that, you know, you can't reconsider or take a different attitude towards without, you know, jettisoning it from the way that you think about your identity. There are ways in which we can come to adopt really sort of constructive and ultimately, right, positive ways of thinking about aspects of our past, of our history, of our heritage, without simply embracing them.
What is the argument for valuing and recognizing that things outside of ourselves are genuine parts of our identity and legitimate components, as opposed to some kind of corruption by the material world?
Yeah, I think it follows from a kind of more general starting point that wouldn't be exclusive to things, but would think about our relationship to all kinds of stuff that we might be interested in saving. And then, you know, things or objects will end up being one example of it. But, you know, I think the really basic idea is that part of how we think about who we are, sort of our sense of self or identity, right, is cashed out in terms of what we care about. And one of the primary ways in which we care about things is through caring for them, which is a way of working to save them, preserve them. You know, there are so many examples of this, right? We care about our kids. Like, how do we do that? Well, a large part of it is that we end up caring for them. You care about a particular tradition, right? Well, you care for it by, you know, continuing to make sure that it happens. Some people care about objects, right? They get very invested in all kinds of different things, classic cars, comic books, and part of how they then, you know, express that caring concern is by caring for those things. And so that link between what we care about and how we care for it, I think is kind of the door through which things end up becoming part of our identity or our sense of self. You know, you can certainly imagine a case where somebody gets really obsessed with caring for some particular thing where there's really no explanation on offer for why they care about it. And you might say, like, that's a really weird thing to care about. Why are you so attached to this object? Or maybe, you know, large quantity of objects. You might say, like, is this just materialism? Right? Like, why do you care about owning every Mustang model that has ever been created? And, you know, if the person has really nothing to say about it besides, you know, say like, well, I've got tons of money, might as well spend it on cars. Then we might really wonder, well, what's going on here? That's puzzling, because in that kind of case, you have someone caring for something that they actually don't seem to really care much about. And so that link between what we care about and what we care for gets severed in this sort of puzzling way. But with lots of objects and the things that people do care about, that link is preserved, right? You can get really thoughtful and meaningful stories about why people care about particular things. And that can help then, you know, ground our understanding of why somebody would then want to care for those things and why that would be so meaningful to them.
How does the discourse change when we move from a very narrow sense of preserving, making sure that something exists, making sure that it's not damaged, making sure that it's accessible to future generations, to the kind of thing that we have to use to care for? And one of the things I'm thinking about is this Gibson Les Paul guitar that I have, that I bought quite a few years ago, that I don't play very often and that I am not a good musician and don't deserve. And there's, you know, your grandfather was a Viennese Jew, so I'm just going to treat you like my therapist here. And, and I have guilt about having this guitar because it's in the guitar case and I don't have time to use it. And I don't have time to really learn the skills for electric guitar, which has been much harder for me than acoustic guitar. And to have a musical instrument, to love a musical instrument is to play a musical instrument and to let a musical instrument live. And I'm not doing that. So how does the conversation change both when preserving things involves doing things that might in fact contribute to their deterioration and doing things that imply a certain kind of desert, entitlement? If a great musician knocked on my door and said, I am the world's greatest blues guitarist, and I know you have this Gibson Les Paul, and I deserve it more than you give it to me, other than property relations, I'd have a hard time countering that. So how does the discourse change when preserving things and loving things involves use and involves maybe even watching them deteriorate over time?
There are cases that we can construct that can make a kind of obsession with preservation seem really, really absurd. So it turns out that there are lots of cases, I mean, maybe even most cases of things that we care about saving are also things that we need to save in a way that allows us to engage with them, even though our engagement with them is not going to help us to save them in the long term. So think about like great works of art, for example. Like light is not good for the long-term preservation of art, but you need the light if you're going to look at the paintings, for example. So, you know, you can imagine who's somebody who said like, oh, we have to save these paintings for the future, like we must preserve them at all costs, let's put them in a lightless vault. And you know, there's something absurd about that on its face, because you might say, well, what's the point? Like, why should we save paintings in a way that is incompatible with us appreciating what makes the paintings worth saving in the first place? And so I think that, you know, there's a similar story to tell about the guitar and lots of other things that we care about saving, is that like the ability to play the guitar is part of what makes it valuable as a guitar, as opposed to as, you know, a piece of sculpture. If that were the only thing that was valuable about it, you might say, okay, we should, you know, adopt some museum norms and say, you know, no touching. But plausibly, that's not enough to explain what's valuable about the guitar. What's valuable about the guitar is its capacity for making music. With respect to the second question, it's complicated, right? I mean, on the one hand, you've got this amazing guitar and you know, you're like, you never play it and nobody ever plays it. You might think, oh, that's kind of a shame. It's sort of a waste. Like the thing that makes it valuable is never kind of realized. And so that might lead you for that reason to think, oh, maybe I should sell this guitar because it's not sort of like being, its value isn't being realized in its current state. But I think that's quite different from the case that you imagined where somebody shows up and says like, well, I'll get more value out of this than you would, right? We don't have to be maximizers about the kind of value that we get from things that we think are worth saving. We don't always have to say like, well, the only way to do this right is to make sure that the absolute maximum capacity of value is wrung from it, right? That's a rather different claim from saying, well, it's better that somebody be able to realize the value of this thing than that it become a kind of relic of the thing that it used to be.
Talk a little bit about how the life of objects actually includes their finality. And what I mean by that is I'm thinking about the author that you cite who refers to the Mona Lisa as not a static object, but a slow event. What does mean for the Mona Lisa to be a slow event, and how does that help explore this question?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting thing where like there are certain things that we think about saving that we tend to think about as objects that are just sort of like always going to be the same way, and we sort of want to keep them the same way all the time. But there's this interesting thing that can happen where if we adopt a different perspective and we think about physical objects as being more like other kinds of things or art forms that are more transient in nature, it could offer a sort of a different perspective on them. So like you think about a performance, for example, right? A performance is a very different kind of thing than a painting or a sculpture. We don't expect the performance to be exactly the same every time. We don't expect it to be sort of like frozen in a certain state. And so, yeah, there's this question about, well, what might change in our practices if we thought about paintings or sculptures as also kind of like long extended events, right? Like performances rather than these kinds of fixed or frozen entities. And it might open up different ways of thinking about their value in terms of change rather than in terms of being static, right? So there are in fact debates about like, what are the best ways to preserve paintings? Should you try to preserve them so that they look exactly the same or to, as close as possible to how they looked when they were just painted? Or is the right way to preserve them to, you know, keep them clean, but actually to like let their hues and pigments fade over time because they are objects that exist in time and they have a history and they have a future. And maybe that's part of what actually is valuable about them, is to sort of let them run their course, even if that means there's only going to be a limited window where we see them in one way, right? But, you know, maybe there's going to be something really fantastic and valuable about seeing them in another way as they continue to degrade. So some artworks, of course, really like lean into this idea and they get very intentional about the thought that you're seeing something in a state of decomposition. That's not necessarily the norm for thinking about a painting like the Mona Lisa, but it does, I think, offer a really interesting alternative perspective for how we might rethink the way in which we think about or approach objects that we're inclined to think about as frozen in time.
Well, suppose someone came along and said, well, we can have the best of both worlds. We're going to take the Mona Lisa, we're going to put it in a vault and protect it so that it lasts another 1,000 years, but we're going to have really excellent digital reproductions available for anyone. There's, I have a colleague who's central, she's doing incredibly interesting work on digital preservation of manuscripts while at the same time doing a whole bunch of repatriation stuff with remains that belong to the local tribes. And there is this sense that digitization, especially putting things on the web, making things reproducible, is democratizing. It gives everyone access to these things. Can we not just take a really, really high resolution scan of the Mona Lisa so we can zoom in and see the brush strokes and we can really get a sense of the texture? We're not allowed to touch it anyway. So is that cut and dry? Is digital reproduction inherently good and to be encouraged?
Yeah, so I think digital reproduction, digital replicas are really fascinating objects, and they can allow us to do all kinds of interesting things that we can't do with originals. I think that the mistake that sometimes gets made is in thinking about a digital replica as a replacement or a substitute for the original. Because although digital replicas can open up these sort of new avenues for different ways of appreciating them. For example, we might be able to like manipulate them in different ways, right? Like think about or sort of see, you know, what they would look like under different conditions, sort of accelerate the appearance of the degradation of time, or alternatively keep things looking exactly the same. Even though they offer all of those opportunities, they're also missing other things, right? So like digital replicas don't have the same history as the original. And in fact, the history of the object is often the thing that people really care about, right? So, you know, like if you show somebody an object that they think is an original and they're sort of really sort of in awe of it, and then you say, oh, actually, no, this is like a 3D printed replica that I just made yesterday. For a lot of people, they'd be disappointed. They'd be like, oh, I really thought this was, you know, the real deal. What you're showing me is a knockoff. And I think that there's something to that in contexts where what really matters to people is being in touch with the past, right? Like having that kind of visceral sort of feeling of connection between themselves and a thing that has visited times that they haven't visited. So like the philosopher Caroline Korsmeyer has done some really fantastic work sort of developing the sense of wonder or awe that people experience when they're in touch with genuine things. So I think sometimes that can be lost with replicas. But I don't think that means that replicas are worthless either, right? It's like, I think that they both allow for different kinds of value. So as long as we don't see replicas as just sort of straightforward replacements for originals, I think there's lots of interesting things that we can do with them, like you were mentioning, helping to provide broader access or different ways of engaging with or approaching objects that we wouldn't otherwise be able to touch or manipulate or things like that.
The picture that is the background on my phone is my daughter, Adina. She attended at her school presentation on set design and props in movies. And the speaker was the person who did a bunch of the props for the Star Wars films. And she is posing with R2-D2. And it matters to me that it's the real R2-D2, that it was an R2-D2 that was in the movie. And just that phrase, the real R2-D2, is completely layered, right? Because R2-D2 isn't real. And there are many different R2-D2s, but the authenticity of the fact that this is an R2-D2 that was in the film that is so meaningful to me makes it very, very different than if it were an R2-D2 replica or a Photoshop.
Yeah.
And so there's that aspect, which is meaning and history and all of that sort of stuff. But then there's this whole other scenario that you discuss, where cultural practices and behaviors have certain requirements. You give the example of a project where people programmed robots to perform a traditional Maori dance. And that the idea was, if they have the robots do the dance, then the dance is preserved. But that's objectionable for different reasons, right? What's wrong with just having robots do the dance so that we can all see what it looks like?
Yeah, so like that I think is an example where the replica, let's call it in this case, misses some of the things that are valuable about the thing that it's kind of trying to replicate, right? So the Maori haka, right, as I understand it, is this, you know, really sort of like embodied social, contextual, meaningful performance. And when you have robots performing it, right, robots aren't Maori, they're not part of those communities and cultures, then what you have is something that's literally just going through the motions, right? Like, it may be showing you movements that bodies might go through when performing the haka, but they're not actually performing the haka, because it is deprived of all of that social context and meaning that attends the traditional dance. That's an example where the replica is really missing a lot of what is valuable about the thing that it's trying to preserve. So that seems like a less successful form of replication.
And this, of course, leads right into, you know, rip from the headlines discussion about AI art and computer generated art,
yes,
where lots of people are talking about the fact that it's bad because it's going to replace actors and replace artists, but also it's just not art. If it's not a human being, if there's not a mind behind it, it's something, it's a product, it's an image, but it's not art. Art is a human construct. And this brings in this phrase that you use, that you bring in from political philosophy, participatory good. What is a participatory good? First, what's a good, and what's a participatory good, and what does participatory goods tell us about criteria for and interest in conservation of particularly practices, abstract things like dance, like language, like kinship?
Yeah. So, I mean, a good, as I'm using it here, is just like something that's valuable, something that produces good for us. And a participatory good is something whose value is derived from our engaging with it and in participating with each other in relation to that good, right? So like the value that we derive from it stems from our doing something together. So I think a really great case that helps to sort of like bring out this idea is my colleague Kyle White at the University of Michigan has written some really wonderful stuff about the role that wild rice plays in Potawatomi culture. In that case, there's an object that is valuable. Like there's like a good in the sense of like a food staple, wild rice. But the rice itself doesn't on its own provide all the participatory goods that can attend the practices involved in harvesting wild rice and preparing wild rice to be eaten and the way in which members of the community come together to do those things, right? Those are also really important goods. Those are participatory goods, and they may be anchored on a particular thing or product, like in this case, wild rice. But you can't get all that participatory good by, say, like the U.S. government dropping off sacks of rice, right? Like that's a product, right? Maybe even the product is like in some sense the same thing, but it's devoid of all of the participatory social goods that surround that product. So he talks about wild rice being like a hub for all of this other social good. And there are lots of cases like that where there's a ton of value that comes out of processes of doing things, often together, that are, you know, they might yield certain products, like a group of people coming together to create a mural, for example, that leads to a certain product, right? Maybe there's like, you know, there's a painting on the wall at the end of the day. But the value isn't just in the product. It's in the particular process through which it was created, with people, right, working collaboratively to envision and design and create this thing. So I think that, you know, to get back to the AI thing, I think one of the things that is really like troubling about lots of AI generated products like images or essays, if you're a college professor, right, is that they can produce a product, and you know sometimes that product is even like pretty good, like as a product, but it's devoid of all of this process that should really be the focus of our attention and from which a lot of the meaning of the product is supposed to be derived.
I think this phrase participatory good, you use the example of the essay, and I was having a similar thought while you were talking, because as the pressure to have online education and what's called asynchronous education, for those not in universities, it's pre-recorded lectures where the students watch and take quizzes and they don't interact with other people or the teacher or the students, that part of what is valuable about education is the community of inquiry that you create. Being in the classroom is valuable in and of itself, independent of the answers to the test or the knowledge you walk away from. And the ability to, I have a refrain that I give to my students all the time, particularly when they're struggling with some difficult stuff or anxious about papers. I always say, if you knew how to do this, you wouldn't have to take the class, right? That this idea that they want to get an A right away and they want to be able to do everything right away. And if they don't know how to do it right away, they're bad students. But the purpose of the class is to be together, to have this joint experience and to develop over time the skills that you don't have. And I think this notion of participatory good is really powerful. Could you talk a little bit about the debate about museums? That there are people who regard museums as fundamentally good, and that artifacts should be in museums because there's air conditioning and there's expert preservation experts and all of this stuff. But there are concerns about that model, and I'll give away some of the punchline, the centralization of it. Mm-hmm. What's the debate about museums and what are the two sides of the conflict?
I've written various critical things about museum practice in the past, and I also love museums. And I think that's something that sometimes can get lost in these debates, right? It's like, when you love something, you want it to be the best that it can be. So I'm a huge fan of museums, but I think sometimes museum practices to be revised. So when it comes to debates about repatriation, for example, which we've touched on a little bit.
For our listeners, repatriation is when archaeologists or anthropologists or museums have remains, often usually indigenous remains, they're discovered and the remains or the artifacts associated with them are given back to the community. And often the community will have ceremonies to recognize them, whether they are funerals or religious rites or things like that. This happened at our university. We discovered boxes and boxes of bones, Native American bones. And the president and my colleague has been working very, very closely with the tribes to repatriate the remains so that the tribes feel that their ancestors and the people that they care about have come back home again. So just as a background, that's what repatriation means. So sorry,
yes,
please go on.
Yes, absolutely. And it's, you know, it's not only, I think, a good thing to do, it's also legally required for institutions that take federal money in accordance with the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act of 1990. And unfortunately, one thing that we know is that just because laws are on the books doesn't mean that they're going to be followed.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Unless people are actually paying attention to whether they're followed. So there's one sort of like vein of thinking about museums, the sort of like encyclopedic museum model, of which the British Museum, which we talked about earlier, is kind of a paradigm where it's, you know, it's like the cabinet of curiosities model, where you have, you know, instances, great art and artifacts from all over the world that are available for people to see all in one place. And, you know, I actually think that there's something lovely about that idea, provided that the collection is assembled and maintained in a morally upstanding way. And what we know is that lots of museums are full of stuff that was, you know, stolen from people, right, or was the product of various forms of colonial or imperial acquisition. So, you know, I think that the key is not to say like museums are perfect the way they are, or museums should be emptied of all of their collections. But, you know, there's a lot of happy space in the middle, where people who are in positions of institutional authority in museums can work collaboratively with members of communities who maybe have had parts of their heritage stolen or are unjustly acquired by these institutions. There's lots of different ways in which they can collaborate in order to find ways of meeting in the middle and allowing for people to learn from these histories, right, without thinking about the museum as just being this kind of, yeah, like cabinet of curiosities model, where everything's just there for all of us to look at just because it's valuable or worth engaging with. And, you know, sometimes museums engage in important forms of repatriation, but then they sort of like don't. They sort of like bury the lead, right? Because maybe they're embarrassed about it, or because they think it's going to draw a negative press. But I actually think those are occasions to celebrate, provided that all parties are on board to tell people about, to like help them understand why the museum is going through this process, what the value is in returning objects to communities.
There's also just the general question of public access and who gets to see it. When the National Endowments for the Arts lost a lot of their funding, yes, the Metropolitan Museum of Art took a little hit in New York City, but what really took a hit were all of the traveling exhibits that mm-hmm. brought this art and brought dance and other things to towns like Grand Forks, North Dakota, and to other places where people who will never go to New York City or couldn't afford to go to the museums would get to see it in their local hometown, because part of having this heritage is sharing it with as many people as possible, which is a whole other set of conversation. But how do we as individuals start to think about what is important to us to dedicate our time, our money towards preserving things, to engaging in stewardship? How would you recommend our listeners take a step back and ask, what do I think is worthwhile to contribute to make sure that this thing, whatever it is still around or still valued or still remembered somewhere down the line?
At the end of the day, although we often focus on the really sort of outstanding, emblematic things, and our conservation efforts often get focused on, you know, like saving the iconic national park or, you know, saving the things that are in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Those are certainly good things to do. Those things already have a lot of people's time and attention and resources. So I actually think one of the most important things that we can do as individuals when it comes to our sort of collective effort to save things that are valuable is to save the things that matter to you. And it doesn't even matter, I think, if they're valuable to a bunch of other people, or if they're really things that are valuable only to, you know, a small local community. But it's sort of, if we each devote time and attention to saving the things that are meaningful to us, the things without which we would feel we had lost some sense of who we are, then we will all collectively end up saving a lot of things in the world that really matter to people. And so that's what I would recommend starting with.
I think that's a really helpful answer, because it reminds us first and foremost of our own agency, right? And,
yes.
And that we are participants in this, and we can make decisions for ourselves, and we don't have to ask the grand political questions about whether or not the indigenous tribe of the Amazon, you know, needs to be photographed, but we can ask, what is it that's in our drawers? What is it that's been handed down that it's about us? Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us on Why. The book is very accessible for all people, and I think it's a really useful starting point for people who want a sense of the agenda of this issue as a whole. So I really enjoyed this, and I thought about a lot of stuff that I never really thought about. So, Eric, thank you very much for joining us on Why.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to be here.
You have been listening to Eric Catala-Mathis and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'll be back with a few more thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking with Eric Catala-Mathis about conservation in the larger sense, about what kind of things we should preserve, what kind of things we should pass on to the next generation. And we spent not very much time talking about the environment, but a lot of time talking about objects. And I'm looking around my office and I'm thinking about all the stuff I have, and I'm wondering what's going to happen to it when I retire, what's going to happen when I downsize, what's going to happen as my daughter gets older, what kind of things do I want her to remember? But also, I have my students that I want to pass ideas on to and practices on to and values on to. And I have my community and my country. And some of that stuff is embodied in a painting or a book or a guitar. And some of that is embodied in the way that people have lunch together or sing songs together or pray together or the stories that they tell. And it can be really overwhelming, and it can be layered with all sorts of complicated moral questions. I actually inherited from my grandmother a real mink coat that's probably 100 years old, and it's a mink coat, and I don't like the idea that there's a mink coat, and I don't necessarily want to sell it, but it feels wasteful to destroy it. I think you can pull all that thread on your own. Do I want to pass this mink coat on to the next generation? I don't. But do I want to destroy it and make it even more of a wasteful object? I don't know that I want to do that either. And I can ask those same questions about anything that is meaningful to me, anything that is powerful to me, either negative or positive, or anything that I think someone else might benefit from. And as we concluded in the discussion, while these can be massive political and moral questions, and while they can come from larger social contexts, they're also about ourselves and how we see ourselves, how we live in the world, and what we think is important. And for me, that's about my friends, my community, my students, my family, my wife, and of course, what I want to pass on to my daughter. And I think in the end, many of these questions answer themselves. What is it that I want Adina to have of mine that will make her life better because she has it, as opposed to her being burdened by the detritus of my life? That's an interesting and valuable question, and it allows me to learn about her, about the world, and about myself, and recognizing the place of objects, of practices, of behaviors in self-exploration is a tremendously useful thing to do. With all of that said, if you've been listening to this episode on Sunday evening on Prairie Public, please know that a longer version with almost 30 more minutes of discussion is available online and as a podcast. Visit whyradioshow.org to listen or subscribe for free. That's whyradioshow.org. For everyone else, rate us on iTunes and Spotify to help spread the word about the show. Follow us on all the usual social networks. Our handle is at whyradioshow.org. Instagram is really the only active one. And please help us continue broadcasting by making your tax deductible donation at whyradioshow.org. Click donate in the upper right hand corner to go to UND's alumni donation portal. We exist solely on the money you provide. Thank you again to Eric, the folks at Prairie Public, especially our engineer Tay Calloway, Danielle, who assisted today with the recording. And I am Jack Russell Weinstein signing off for Why Radio. Thank you for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.